a kingdom in the sky, there lived a mighty king who loved his nation. Lost below, they had wandered far and wide, searching for a way to return. And watching helplessly, he tried to whisper to their hearts the only answer. It's not a road or a path that you must find. All I need to hear are the words, we are.
Good evening. Thanks for coming. Tonight, I'd like to make a few dedications. We have, before we begin, just we have a dedication that I would like to do on behalf of myself, as a friend and as a neighbor of a incredible and unusual human being, and also for Mayan Yisrael as a recognition of a super giant in our community. Rav Reb Menachem Mendel Lapkovsky, who had passed away this past Shabbos after battling a very, very difficult illness, passed away much, 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 much too early in his life. Menachem Mendel Halevi ben Rav Nochem. May this share be to the schus of his great neshama. There is no doubt in my mind that he was a great protector and a great merit for this entire community. And I'm sure when he goes up to heaven above, he will continue, and even with greater vigilance and greater dedication to all his friends, all of the community, and all of the Jewish people, fighting for us in front of the heavenly throne and evoking divine mercy, and primarily to his family, to his wife, wonderful wife, and children, and all those that are so brothers or siblings, those who are so close to him, may they not know of any more suffering and pain, and may their separation from Reb Mendel be very, very short. May he return very soon with the coming of Mashiach. I'm sure he's going to be from the first that are going to come back because of his devotion and commitment to the well-being of all the Jews and the caring and the work on his behalf on the coming of Mashiach. So may he return here very, very soon. Another dedication tonight. Tonight's CD was dedicated by my good friend, Reb Shlomo Goldner. This is in honor of his mother's yard site. It's going to be this Friday. Blima Reise Basar Bavram Shlomo on the 17th of Kislev. May her neshama be elevated to the greatest of heights. Draw down lots of blessings to him, to you, to your family, and all that you need. In the physical, in the spiritual, only blessings to all of you. Very big thank you for that. Another dedication tonight was by my wonderful friend and very precious student, Tzviki Adlerstein. This is for Refuah Shleima, for Rachmil Yosef Rachamim ben Mariah Sherachel. May he have a speedy recovery instantly amongst all those that are ill in the Jewish people. I want to thank you, Tzviki, for that phone call last week about how much you enjoyed last week's shir. That was very special for me, so thank you for that. Another dedication tonight was by Max Spielberg. This is in honor of an engagement of a very good friend of his and a young man who davens by us in our shul, a wonderful person, Chaim Zev Abramson's engagement to Devorah Elephant. May they have a wonderful, wonderful, may they get married in an auspicious time, and may they build a beautiful home and for their family, for their children, and a beautiful home for the Jewish people. May be much, much nachas, and may the wedding be b'shat tov u'mitzlachas. And thank you, Max, for this dedication. Another dedication we have this week was by Milano Shetelsale. Oh, this is different. A dedication. This is to let everybody know, both the men and the women. The men, that they should allow their women to go, and the women so that they should go. This Saturday night, across the street, there on one, what is the address? 115 North La Brea, between First and Beverly, is a great Shetel sale at Week Sale this Saturday night and Sunday. And everybody should know about this. It should be with a lot of atzlacha. Thank you to this dedication. Another dedication was by Shelley and Shirley Perlis. This is in honor of Shelley's father, who had passed away, Yitzchak ben Shlaima. May this be to the zchus of his neshama. And I'm sure the merit of this year will carry him and be for him at a time of need. And may this send a lot of blessings to the entire Perlis family. Thank you so much. And one last dedication was by an anonymous called up right before the shir that he wants to sponsor this shir in order for Hashem to answer the prayers of all those who pray across the world. Men, women, children, whoever has a prayer that you're asking Hashem to answer, he wants to dedicate this shir for the answering of God, for God answering the prayers of all people that turn to him. I'm sure Hashem hears that, and may that happen right now. Thank you. Max, we just did your dedication, so you'll listen to me. All right. This week's parsha is Parshas Vayishlach. And in the parsha, we're reading how Yaakov is returning back from the house of Lavan. He was in exile. For 20 years, he was away from the land of Israel, away from his parents. Found himself in an alien land, a very unholy land, the land of Charon. By his uncle Lavan, who was the greatest con artist and the greatest cheater. And Yaakov suffered immensely, but over there he managed, against all odds, to build a beautiful family, the tribes of Israel, to amass a fortune, and now he's on his way back. His mother said, I'm going to send you to my brother just for a couple of days. The couple of days turned into 20 years. Now he's journeying back to the land of Israel. However, there's only one dilemma. He has to confront his brother Esav, who's very, very angry at him, or angry is not even the word. It was out to kill him. When Yaakov stole the blessings from him, tricked him by deceiving and taking the blessings that Isaac was initially intending to give to Esav, and Yaakov came and took those blessings. So Esav's evoked his brother's wrath, his brother planned to kill him. Yaakov ran away. Now he's coming back, and he's not exactly sure how his brother is doing. So the pasuk begins, Parshas Vayishlach, Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim, that Yaakov is sending messengers, which were literal angels. Malachim means messengers, but Rashi tells us these were angelic beings that he sent to his brother Esav, al Esav Achiv, to Esav his brother, Arza Seir, to the land of Seir, to the Edom, to the fields of Edom. That's where Esav was. Now, why was he sending messengers? This was a gesture of goodwill. Yaakov wants to make peace. He wants to extend a loving, brotherly hand to his brother, telling him, I know you were upset at me, but I hope now, after this long duration of time, we can work things out, you can accept me, and we can live happily ever after as brothers, as friends. And that's basically what he sends for Esav. Etzav Esav Leimor, this is what you should tell my master Esav. He humbles himself before his brother. Koyamar Avdacha Yaakov, this is what your servant Jacob says. Im Lavan Gariti, I lived with Lavan. Right? I've been there till now I'm coming back, and the like. Now we know that these messengers wasn't just for a peaceful mission, for a delegation just to make nice to his brother Esav. There was something much deeper over here. This is a delegation and a mission in which Yaakov was declaring something about the nature of the world, or the nature where he is standing. What Yaakov was calling on his brother Esav was that Esav should join forces with him, and together they will march to the ultimate redemption. Yaakov believed at that time that he had completed the rectification of what he needed to rectify in order to purify the world and elevate creation to its pristine state for the coming of Mashiach. And he turned to his brother because he knew he can't do it on his own. Because the Jewish people play a major role in the bringing the world to the redemption, but we cannot do it without the Gentile as well. The Gentiles are part of it. When Mashiach will come, it's to the two brothers of Yaakov and Esav. As we see, it says in the prophecy of the coming of Mashiach, it says, "Va'olu Mashiach b'har Tzion," those that were saved, referring to the Jewish people that were saved from the harsh exiles and all the persecutions, we will go up on Mount Zion to the Temple Mount, build the Holy Temple, lishpot eshar Esav, to judge the mountain of Esav. This doesn't mean to get even with Esav. It means the judgment of Esav means to rectification of Esav, the rehabilitation of Esav, because the coming of Mashiach involves when all the nations of the world will recognize God, and the primary force within the non-Jewish world is Esav. And that's why Yaakov knows that he cannot go without Esav. So he's sending his brother Esav a message. And why at this junction? Why is he calling to Esav now? Because at this point, Yaakov had already completed his personal work. We know that in order to bring redemption to the world, one cannot stay secluded in a cave. Because redemption to the world requires bringing divine light to all of creation, to the entire world. So therefore, Yaakov, for the first 70 years of his life, was secluded in the tents of study. He was filling himself, we would say he was absorbing, he was dwelling, and he was marinating in holy light. But he did not in any way have an influence on the world around him. Yaakov went to exile, and for 20 years, he went to a very unholy place. He went to the land of Charan. Charan, as the sages say, means anger. This was the lowliest place. This is the place that is the most anti-godly, the most immoral place in the world in those days. And that's why the very name indicates of how angry it makes God every day when he looks at Charon. Charon means Charon Afshal Olam. This is the place that is what angers Hashem. The people over there were very, very, very ungodly. And Yaakov went to that place in order to do his work and influencing and bringing Kedusha, bringing holiness to Charan. Now that Yaakov had completed his work in Charan, and what was that in Kabbalistic terminology, he elevated all the sparks of holiness, revealing the divine spark that was in Charan. And we see that by Yaakov spending 20 years by Lavan, the liar, because the physical material world and that unholy environment that Lavan represented is deceptive, is constantly lying to us. Yaakov went down over there, and what did he do? He managed to take all of Lavan's possession, which was Lavan's wealth, and he integrated into his own, making it his own wealth. This wasn't, God forbid, he didn't cheat him even once. He was dealing with Lavan, but by doing that, he extracted the energy of Lavan, and he brought it into holiness, which was the sublimation of the sparks of holiness that were in Charan, indicated in the sheep of Lavan, which now became the sheep of Yaakov through this whole deal that they had made with the spotted and speckled and striped sheep that was discussed in last week's Torah portion. So at this point, Yaakov had completed his job in the purification of the world of Charan, which represents the general unholy world. Now he's coming back, and he said, "I finished my job. What's with you, my dear brother? Where are you holding in your work? Because I know there's a big portion of the creation and a big part of the world that God has given you the job in order for you to sublimate, in order for you to get yourself ready for the redemption." The messengers come to Esav, and disappointedly, they're coming back to Yaakov. And what are they saying to him? They're saying, "Your brother Esav is not there. He's not there at all. Not only isn't he ready to assist you and to join with you, but he's coming to wage war against you. He's coming with 400 men that are armed to their teeth, and they are out to destroy you and your family completely." They are waging war against the forces of holiness, which means that Esav is still in a very, very, very dark state. And in this, as we also see that Esav was bent on the destruction of Yaakov, the little confrontation that they had where Esav almost bit off Yaakov's head. And also, we have the angel of Esav who spent the entire night wrestling with Jacob. It says that Yaakov that night stayed alone and he was wrestling with an angel. That was the angel of Esav, the spirit of Esav, that was fighting with Yaakov. So we see that Esav is still, he isn't ready yet. Okay? So what does Yaakov say to Esav after they meet? He says, they meet and miraculously nothing happened to Yaakov. But then he tells Esav, you know, you go back home. Esav says, come with me, join me. I'm going back to Edom, come for a visit. We'll have a barbecue. We'll spend the afternoon together. And Yaakov says to Esav, I'm going to come, but not yet. I have children. It's going to take a long time. It's going to take me, the children go slowly, the sheep, they can't walk so fast. You're together with a bunch of horsemen. You'll go quickly. I'm going to come. I'm eventually going to get to you. So simply it means, you know, give me a few weeks and I'll be there. Give me a few days. But Rashi says he never went there. So when did Yaakov go? What Yaakov meant until I will eventually come. It will now, this dual achievement that we were supposed to do, this job that we were supposed to do together, has now been put off for a little while. It's going to take another 3.5 millennium, 3,500 years, until we're going to meet again. You are ready to be elevated as a result of the children, which is Yaakov's descendants of the Jewish people amongst the nations, and the purification that is being done in a very detailed, meticulous way, bit by bit by bit, when the Jewish people are scattered amongst all the nations of the world, doing our godly things amongst the nations, bringing about a purification in all of creation. This is the higher and deeper story that is going on between Yaakov and Esau. So we understand that when Yaakov sends a message to Esau, and the message is of such significance, he's talking about him being ready for the redemption. This tells us that these two verses, which is the message that he's telling the messengers, the angels, to give over to Esau, this must contain within itself the secret of redemption. Yaakov is declaring, I am ready for the redemption. As he's saying, I am ready for the redemption, it's with these words. So if we want to gauge within ourselves if we are ready for the redemption, which we all know that we need the redemption, we cannot wait any longer, because as we're seeing the world, where the world is getting to, and the difficulties and what happened in Israel last week, which is just a temporary pause, which God should help and should protect us all. But we all know that we haven't resolved the issues at all. And it's clear to all of us that the issues will not be resolved unless something divine and something godly is going to happen. So we know Mashiach has to come. And the question is, what is it that we do to make ourselves ready for the coming of Mashiach? So we have to be in Yaakov's shoes. We have to be where Yaakov is. So let's see what Yaakov says in his declaration when he says, I am ready for Mashiach. So let's see what does he say to Esau? He says, "Koyamar avdecha Yaakov, so says your servant Yaakov. Im Lavan garti, I lived with Uncle Lavan. I was by our Uncle Lavan. I lived over there. Ve'echar ad ata, I delayed until now. I left, I ran away, because I know you were angry at me. Now I'm back. I've been there, I've delayed here all this time. And I, again, his main thing is, he says, I lived with Lavan. Then he continues and he says, "Vahili shor v'chamor, I have an ox, I had a donkey, tsoin sheep, ve'eved and servants, v'shifcha and a maid, ve'eshlecha, and I am sending lahagid la'adoni, I am here relating to you, to my master, limtzechein b'enecha, because I want to find favor in your eyes." So let's take each statement, every part of what Yaakov is saying. The first thing he says is, Im Lavan Garti, I lived with Lavan. What does he mean by that? So first, on the simple level, you know, before we go into the more mystical meaning in which he is speaking to Esav in terms of this cosmic conversation of being ready for the redemption, but just as him trying to appease his brother, what does he say to his brother? I lived with Lavan. He uses the word Garti. Garti means, comes from the word Ger. Ger means a stranger. Yaakov is saying, when I lived in Lavan's house, I lived as a stranger. Don't think for one moment that I was living a very glorious, comfortable life, that I was living in a mansion, I had everything. No, I lived in poverty. I lived a very difficult life. I lived like an immigrant, just came off the boat. I wasn't settled, and I was never invited. They never looked at me as one of them. I was always looked as the stranger, and therefore my life was very, 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 very uncomfortable. And so that was a matter in order that he wants to appease his brother Esau. Here, you know, even though you couldn't catch me, but I was suffering in the last 20 years. Because I lived like a ger, I lived like a stranger. So this was meant to appease Esau. Now Rashi says, there's another meaning to the word garti. Aside from meaning that I was a stranger, it also means, if you'd rearrange the letters of the word garti, it also means Gimel Reish Taf Yud stands for Tar Yag, 613. And he's saying to him, I lived with Lavan, but I kept the mitzvot, the mitzvahs. How many mitzvahs are there? There are 613 commandments. So even though I was in the house of Lavan, I kept the mitzvahs. What is the significance? Why is he relating this to Esav? Sounds simple. He was appeasing Esav, but on the other hand, he was also letting Esav know, don't mess with me. Why? Because one of the blessings, initially when Isaac blessed both of them, Yitzchak and Esav, and later Esav came back and complained. He said, didn't you give me any blessings? So Yitzchak says to him, if your brother will not keep the Torah, then you will be able to remove your yoke from the yoke of because your brother is your master. But the moment he becomes negligent, the moment he becomes light in his observance, so then you're going to be able to remove the shackles and you're going to take control over your brother. So that's why he tells Esav, you should know. You probably think that when I lived in such an un-Jewish, non-Jewish environment, where observance was so difficult, I probably am not keeping much. There's no resemblance of who I was in the past. It's not that way. I lived with Glavan, but I kept all the mitzvahs. The word garti means taryag. I kept the 613 commands. Okay? That's what Rashi says on the simple level. Now, we need to understand over here, whenever there is two interpretations of a word in the same, whenever a word or a phrase has two explanations, the two explanations are not unrelated. The two explanations are intertwined one with each other. Which means that when Yaakov is saying, I lived with Lavan, implying two things. Number one, I lived like a stranger and I wasn't comfortable. Number two, I kept all the commandments. These two things are interdependent one on each other. So we need to understand what is the relationship of them. Now let's continue. What does he say next to him? Next thing, what does he say next? He says, Vayehili, when I was there, there was to me. And he goes on to speak about the wealth that he accumulated when he was in Esav's house. He says, I had an ox, I had a donkey, I had sheep, I have a servant, and I have a maidservant. Now, even though he says in the singular, Rashi tells us that an ox means many oxen, and donkey means many donkeys, meaning I made a killing when I was at Lavan's house. Now, why would he say this to his brother? Why would he tell his brother, I became a wealthy man? So Rashi says, what he was saying is, yes, indeed, you're going to meet me now. I want to give you a heads up. You're going to meet me, and I'm going to be this. I'm coming back with this massive caravan of cattle and all this great wealth. I want you not to be jealous, because the success that I had is not from the blessings that I have taken away from you, that I have tricked you, because these are not those blessings. Those blessings weren't fulfilled. Because when Isaac blessed me, when Yitzchak blessed me, he blessed me with the dew of heaven. Mitala Shamayim with the dew of heaven, umishmane aretz from the fat of the earth. Now these cattle, the wealth that I have, doesn't come not from the dew of heaven, not from the dew of heaven, and not from the fat of the earth. So if I would have a lot of real estate and I would have a lot of farms, and so then you can say, well, that prosperity came because of blessings I've taken away from you. But that's not what I have. I'm a nomad. I'm traveling. I'm like a Bedouin moving around with my cattle. I don't have a place to be. So this is not the blessings that I have stolen from you, and therefore you don't have to be upset at me. Okay? The Medrash tells us that when Yaakov is saying Vayehili Shor, and again the problem over here, why does he say the singular? Again, we could say, Rashi says that sometimes we say, for some reason in the Hebrew language, we use a singular term and it leaves many. But you have to know, that is usable, that is acceptable, but we still need a reason why
why the Torah would use that word instead of just saying, if he says many oxen, he could have said, Vehili Shoirim, I had a lot of oxen. So the Medrash says he's implying to one ox. And when he says Chamori, he's referring to one donkey. He's referring to a specific ox and a specific donkey. The ox that he's referring to is the descendant of Yosef. Yaakov has now, the sons were born to him, Yosef was born. Joseph is going to have a great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson in the end of days. And that is going to be the one who's going to herald in the Messianic age, the days of Mashiach. We know that Mashiach, the anointed one, there are two Mashiachs. There is Mashiach ben Yosef, the descendant of Yosef, who is the one who does all the preliminary work and preparation, who wages war, whatever the wars are. Now this again, well, as long as we have these ideas, when we read in the Midrashim, wars, they don't necessarily mean physical wars. These can all be spiritual battles. But Mashiach ben Yosef is the one who fights the wars, and he paves the road for Mashiach ben David, for the descendant of Mashiach that comes from David, King David, who is a descendant from Yehuda. So Yaakov says to Yosef, Yaakov says to Esav, in his message, he says, Vahili Shor, I have an ox, which means I have the power of redemption. I have Yosef, who's compared to an ox. We say in the blessings, Moshe Rabbeinu blesses the Jewish people, and he says, Bechor Shoro, when he speaks to Yosef, Bechor Shoro Hodor Loi, Bechor, the firstborn of the ox, Hodor Lo is beauteous to him, referring to Joseph's, compared to an ox. So that's why he refers to the descendant of Yosef as, I have an ox. And when he says, I have chamor, I have a donkey, he's referring to the Mashiach, the descendant of King David, because Mashiach, the prophecy relating to Mashiach, one of the prophecies describes Mashiach as ani verochev ala chamor, as a poor man who is riding on a donkey. Mashiach comes riding into town on a donkey. And that is why, when Yaakov is alluding to it, by saying, I had a donkey. Okay? So now we need to understand, first of all, the flow. I lived with Lavan. I kept the mitzvahs. I have now an ox and a donkey, which means, as we mentioned, I have Mashiach. I'm ready for Mashiach. So what's the flow? What's the connection? I lived with Lavan, and now I have an ox and a donkey. And secondly, we need to understand, why is he referring to Mashiach as a donkey? The one that comes on a donkey. Because it's not so sure that Mashiach is going to come on a donkey. We don't know. What do we mean by that? The Talmud tells us in Masechta Sanhedrin, in Tractate Sanhedrin, that there are two ways that Mashiach can come. One way is he can come with the clouds of the heaven. The Pasuk says, Aru imanana shemaya, that he will behold the one that looks like man, will come down with the clouds of heaven. That's the Pasuk. I don't know exactly where the Pasuk, I think in Daniel, and Daniel. That Mashiach will appear with the clouds of heaven. There's another verse that says, Ani, he's a poor man, a humble person, and he's riding on a donkey. And the sages say it's a contradiction. Here it seems like he's coming with a spectacular miracle. He's coming from the sky. Here it says he's coming more of a narrow. Rashi says the difference is, if he's coming through the clouds, he'll be coming swiftly, like the clouds come rolling in unexpectedly without any warning. If he's coming like a donkey, the donkey is a very lazy animal, which means it's a very slow progression. It's a painful, slow, until Mashiach comes. So which one is it? So the sages say it depends. Lo yizachu, if the Jewish people are not, if the world is not meritous, if we're not worthy of the redemption, and the redemption is only coming because there is no choice, because the exile cannot go on any longer. There has not been, but we're not really worthy for the redemption. Then it's going to be a slow, prolonged redemption until it's going to happen. It's going to be a lazy redemption and a very natural redemption. If, however, we're in a state of zachu, if we merit, then it's going to be spectacularly miraculous. It's going to come from above. Mashiach is coming from the heaven. Now, the question is like this. Yaakov has completed his work. Yaakov was in the house of Lavan. He had a miserable time. And all that time, he worked beyond with superhuman efforts, on consistently, continuously observing the mitzvahs, and fighting the forces of evil and the unholy demons that were filled with charon. He was battling with darkness, and he triumphed over them. So Yaakov definitely is in a state of what we call zachu. He is purified. He is merited. He merited the redemption. That's why he's coming to tell his brother. He says, I know I'm ready. I'm ready to march to the ultimate redemption. So then if that's the case, so then Mashiach is going to come through a state of zachu, of having merit, and then it's going to come through the heaven. It's going to be miraculous. So then he should have indicated to Esav, to his brother, that I have a cloud. Why is he saying I have a donkey? Which, as we said, donkey is only the undesirable way, the one that we don't want Mashiach to come. Why isn't Yaakov using the preferable way, Mashiach coming in the clouds? He could have said, I have a cloud. Why is he alluding to it as a donkey? So to understand all of this, let's understand a little bit the process. The process of how do we come from exile to redemption, which really gets to the heart of issues of why God created the world. Mashiach is not just a nice bonus. Mashiach is the purpose of creation. The world was created for the days of Mashiach. That's its entire purpose. Everything until Mashiach is just preparation. We're trying to prepare ourselves for the redemption, but the world has not yet begun to live a true, real day, a real life, because real life is only going to be in the days of Mashiach. So what really is the Messianic era? What has to be done in order for Mashiach to come? And the idea briefly is as follows. We discussed this many times in earlier classes. And that is like this. When God created the world, God made the world in a manner in which the creation blocks the creator. The creation conceals and hides the divine life force that's creating it. And that is so much part of the creation that it is the definition. It is that the definition of the world, the way the world is called Olam. And Olam means world in Hebrew. Olam means helem, concealment, which means the very definition of a creation is that it's meant to conceal God. And that's why when we look at the creation, and sometimes we have questions, and when there are things in this world that seem to be pointing that there is no God, it shouldn't shock us. If God created the world, wouldn't God want to be known in his creation? Wouldn't he make it obvious? No, on purposely he made it not obvious. He concealed himself. That's the entire nature of creation. How much did God conceal himself? Well, the concealment comes in stages. In the higher spiritual realms, in the upper worlds, because the world is multi-layered, many, many levels. In the supernal spiritual worlds above, the blockage, the obscuring and the concealment of divinity is only a little bit. And they feel the creations acknowledge, recognize, and serve the Creator continuously all the time with all their soul and all their might. Angels sing to God all day long and they never get bored. They don't do anything else. But as the creation progresses, lower and lower and lower, it starts getting darker and darker and darker until the final stage of creation, which is this physical material world, in where there is the final existence, the completed creation, is a creation that is so thick, coarse, and dense that you don't feel any divine energy. There's not even a trace of spirituality, of holiness within the creation. In truth, all of the creation is submerged in the infinite light of God, to the point that from God's perspective, the creation is so not, it's so nullified that it doesn't even exist. It's so unified with him. All of existence is but an expression of God, and the creation itself is submerged in the infinite light of Hashem. That's the way it truthfully is. But the creation, the physical world, the earth, is oblivious to it. To the point that you can have people that are living their lives. We can forget God for a second, a minute, a day, a month, a year, 10 years, a lifetime. A person can live in total denial of anything higher than himself, his or herself. That there is any spiritual force behind the universe that's creating it and has an interest in creation. What's the purpose of creation? God's challenge to the world is, find me. I hid and I concealed myself from you, and I want you to dig into yourself. I want you to dig into the creation. Look and search until you discover me, until you reveal me within yourself. That's the challenge. How do we And how does that happen? Well, most of the bulk of the task was given to the Jewish people. God sent very, 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 very high souls. The Jewish souls are very special souls into the world. Jewish souls have an innate recognition, deep, deep, deep fundamental recognition in God, because at the core of the Jewish soul is a spark of God himself. And therefore, the Jew in essence cannot really, really truthfully deny God. And even if he tries to be an atheist, he or she has to keep on reminding themselves again and again and again and again and again that they are an atheist, because it's very hard for a Jew to be an atheist, because there is an intrinsic, inherent knowledge and recognition and light that is illuminating their soul. Of course, a person can try to block it, but if they try to do that, it takes work. That's why a Jewish atheist is the most pronounced atheist, who keeps on reminding you that they really don't believe. Another atheist, an atheist, forget it, you know. An atheist makes a declaration one time and leaves everybody alone. But the Jew can't. Why? Because inherently the Jew knows God with an intrinsic internal knowledge. The Jewish soul comes into the world to polish, to purify, to remove the klipa, the shell, the blockage, to the real, reveal divinity in the world. And the instruments through which we reveal God in the world is through the Torah and the mitzvahs, the application of Torah study in the world, and the mitzvah observance, whether we see it or not, brings a purification in the world, cleanses and purifies, removes the obstacles, removes the blockages, and opens up the flow that the physical world should not only not block God, but express and reveal divinity. That's the purpose. We begin with what? We begin with our own bodies. You have a soul and we have a body. The body, physical body, that's not only the body. It's a body with an animal consciousness, which we call the ego. Where the soul, it's also a spirit, where the soul enclothes itself, wraps itself in an animal, in an ego. The ego is a creature of darkness. It's a being that lives in denial. The ego only knows of self. It doesn't want to submit to anything higher. From the ego's perspective, life is about having a good time. About me enjoying myself, me becoming as popular as I can, as powerful as I can. My life is serving myself. From the soul's perspective, Ani avdecha ben amasecha. I'm your servant, the son of your maid. My entire existence is a perpetual hineni. I'm here to serve you, God. What now? I know you are responsible. You're the source. You are my everything. You're my power every moment, every breath I take. Not only is it the power, you are my life. You are my body, you are my soul. You're my bed, you're my house. You're my wife, you're my children. You are the sky, you're the trees. You're the animals, everything, because it's all you. Everything physical is just a condensing of divine energy. Right? The soul knows that. And the soul has to, the first process is to peel away the klipa, the shell, beginning where? Beginning with the body. So the Tanya, in this chapter 37, makes a very, from the Arizal, these are all concepts derived from the teachings of the Arizal, the Grand Kabbalist, in which he says like this, an amazing thing. He says there are 600,000 souls that come down to purify the world. Those are the 600,000 souls that stood at Sinai. Okay, the souls, that people that went out of Egypt, 600,000 souls. They vest themselves in 600,000 egos. We might call them 600,000 super souls that vest themselves in 600,000 super egos, okay? Which in turn vest itself in together. The soul inside the ego comes down in a body. Now, those were the original Jews who lived there to receive the Torah. Then, that very, very super soul gets splintered into, each one of those souls gets splintered into 600,000 small little specks of souls. So now you have already millions and millions of Jews that come to the world throughout the entire duration of history. They vest themselves in 600,000 egos, super egos, which every animal soul gets then splintered into 600,000 little egos, little eyes. Okay, and each soul enters into one of those miniature egos, and that comes down in a body at any point in time in history. Now, when that soul comes into the body, and when it gets the body, when one manages to turn their life around from serving me, serving myself, doing my thing, and instead I recognize every morning it's a struggle. Whoever thinks this is not a constant struggle, it's a big mistake. There's no such a thing as just making this happen one time, besides for a very big tzaddik. Except for very few tzaddikim who managed to make their soul, their energy and their life once and for all and never have to deal with the darkness anymore, that's possible. But very few people. Most people, this is a perpetual battle, continuously. It's every single week, every single day, every single hour. It helps when we wake up in the morning and we take a deep breath and say, Moda ani lefanecha, in which we're devoting ourselves, when we're just waking up, recognizing, Shechzarta binishmasi, you gave me my soul, you're responsible for my life. This body over here, this physical body with my 248 limbs, is going to be dedicated and devoted to serving you, my master, serving you, God, all day long. I'm going to study your Torah, I'm going to pray to you, I'm going to do mitzvahs, and all the time that I'm going to do, all the other physical things that I'm going to do, it's going to be geared towards helping me and assisting me do mitzvahs. Okay? When we do that, that's the sublimation of the body. That's the purification of our own body, but there's more than just the sublimation of our own body, because that's the beginning. But how do we practify all of creation? How do we get the entire physical universe to be polished and be transparent to holiness and godliness? So here is the next stage. God divided 600,000 sections. Every part of the universe, every part of time and space falls into one of these segments of the 600,000. Every single soul has one 600,000th, one little part, which is quite big if you took consider the whole universe, in which that soul needs to purify. It needs to remove the blockage and express God through it. And when we, down here below, on any given day, are doing a mitzvah and doing a godly thing, we are affecting a huge chunk of the world, whether we know it or not. We're having a huge effect. Our actions, both for the good or the opposite, have huge repercussions, affect very, very distant corners of the world, in which we're bringing holiness and spirituality and receptiveness to divinity to many people, to objects. That's why God created us in a manner in which, in order to live, just to survive, we need to be sustained by the parts, by things that there are in the world. A human being is not self-sustainable. We need the mineral, we need the vegetation, we come onto plant life, we come onto animal life, and we're social beings, so we need to help each other out. So by doing that, we're interdependent on so many things, and when we keep our minds focused and we do the godly thing, then all these things that are somehow assisting us in doing a mitzvah, they too are purified, sublimated, and made ready for Mashiach's light to shine through them, for God's light to shine through them in the days of Mashiach. So as simple as something as this, you go and you buy a sweater, and the sweater is made in Indonesia, even if maybe a Jew has never gone to Indonesia or not many Jews have been there doing mitzvahs over there. But when you're wearing that sweater and you're using that sweater to assist you to go to shul, to study Torah, to do a mitzvah, to do any other kind of mitzvah, then you're sublimating all the sweater, not only the sweater, but all the people who worked in the factory that made that sweater. All those things are being more receptive to divinity. That's what the Arizal teaches us. Even if we don't see the direct effects, we're having a huge impact on the world. And only God knows which sweater belongs to you, or which sweater belongs to me. And I get my sweater, you get your shoes, I get my shoes. We all get that which we need linked up, and there are thousands of calculations. It's amazing how billions of calculations in every little thing in our life in which God is hooking us up with exactly that moment and exactly that item which is related to our soul, which we can use it now to assist us in doing a mitzvah so that we can sublimate it and make it holy. That is the purpose of creation. Now the problem is like this. It's very possible that it goes the other way. When the soul comes into the body, instead of the soul mastering the body, taking charge, and getting the body to become a servant of the soul, so that the body and the part of the world that is hooked up to the body, that is connected to the body, in order for that to become instruments of holiness, it can work the opposite, where the body doesn't comply with the soul. And instead, the person listens to their ego and not to their neshama. And then the opposite happens. Not only aren't we making the world brighter, but we're making the world darker, which means that the forces of darkness are not only not being elevated, they're actually deriving energy from the soul, which means they're taking more energy from our Jewish holy soul and using that extra energy to, God forbid, create more darkness and more concealment. So this is a constant struggle, and the struggle will go on until Mashiach comes. There's accumulation of thousands of years of mitzvahs, which is standing, which has already purified the world. There's only tiny, 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 maybe tiny little crumbs left that have not yet been finished. Probably that has been finished as well. And we're already there, maybe just one little mitzvah that's left, but we're almost, we're so close for the ultimate purification. Now the question is, how do we do this? How do we assure that the body is a servant of the soul and not the soul becomes the servant to the body? So it depends on how we look at life. If, when we come down into this world, the body, we look at life, that this physical world is a permanent residence, this is the place in which, this is where life is, physical life, material pleasures and delights, that is what life is all about, then it's very hard to curb the desires and wants of the body. Because after all, this is where it's happening. How can I give up on the opportunity of physical pleasure? But if a person keeps their mind open and the understanding that the physical incarnation is only very, very short. We're here for a short period of time, 70, 80, 90, 120 years, everybody should live a very long life. It's still very, very, very minute and very little in comparison to the grandeur of a person's life when the soul is in heaven. And the spiritual pleasures and the spiritual delights and the connection to God and the spiritual world. So if a person bears that in mind, then you recognize that physicality is a chance, it's an opportunity in which we can fulfill the purpose, the God-given purpose that He has given each and every one of us. And then we stay focused. If the physical becomes the focus of our life, amassing wealth, having every pleasure and every delight, that's of course a distraction. And then it goes the other way. So this is what our forefather Yaakov taught us in this week in the Parsha. He says, in order for Mashiach to come, the first lesson and the most important thing is, Im Lavan, when you go down to live in Uncle Lavan's house, which means in the duration of time that you're coming down into the house of the Karn artist Lavan, which is the physical world, which deceives, which is a liar, it deceives, it makes itself appear as if it is the ultimate dream and the ultimate existence, when it's really not. Okay. When you go down to Lavan's house, if you settle in and you become a resident, you apply for citizen papers immediately, and you settle in, and this becomes your identity, then you're in trouble. Yaakov says, Im Lavan Garti, when I went to Lavan, I remained an immigrant. I remained a stranger, which means I never took it seriously. Physical achievements, accomplishments, possessions, what Lavan has, tzon, sheep, bakar, cattle, which in those days represented material wealth. These things, what the whole world of Lavan was garti. That's not who I really am. That's what we find in the end, later in the parasha, Yaakov says something interesting. He says that, it says that when Yaakov comes after he meets Esav, he goes to the city of Shechem, and it says that vayiven lo bayis, Yaakov builds himself a house, ulemiknehu, and for his cattle, asa sukkahs, he made a sukkah. Simply it means, for him he made a house, and then barns for his cattle. The deeper meaning is, vayiven lo bayis, to his neshama, to his soul, he built himself a home. Which means matters of his soul were so important that his most important room in his home was his library, where he had his books, where he had his... The most important place in Yaakov's house was his guest house, in which he did hachnosas orchem, and he invited guests, and he helped people out. His mitzvah world was his home. He took very seriously. Lemiknehu, his acquisitions, the things that he's buying. Buying means the material world. Things, matters that relate to the physical body. That's called acquisitions of the soul, because it's not really... A soul in heaven didn't need it. And even when the soul comes down over here, it can use these things to help it do mitzvah, so it's an acquisition. For that, he made temporary dwellings. He made a bias. So that's what Yaakov is saying to Lavan. He says to him, "Im Lavan garti," I'm sorry, to Esav. He says, "When I was in Lavan," which means my involvement in the physical world was such that garti, I always felt like I'm not there. It wasn't my life. It was a very time, I was like a tourist. I was passing through very quickly. And therefore, I didn't make a big deal out of it. Therefore, what is the flip side of that? If the material possessions weren't important to him, what was important to me was Taryag Mitzvahs, the 603, the word Garti itself, which means a stranger, means also 613. Because a precondition for the fulfillment of mitzvahs, the way a person should do a mitzvah, which means really devoted to mitzvah observance, really dedicated to mitzvah, requires a detachment from the pleasures and the deep involvement of physicality. A person can't have it both, because for a simple reason. Because if a person takes physical life and pleasures very seriously, it becomes a distraction. Because you never have time to study Torah. I mean, after all, you can always be richer. No matter how rich you are, you can always make more money. And make more money, obviously, by spending more time in your office, in your business. That, what is that going to do? So that's so you don't have time to, you have time to study, you have time to do a mitzvah. You don't have money for a mitzvah because you can use the money to buy another yacht or go on some other grand vacation and splurge on who knows what. Something very silly. But if a person has their mind knowing physical life is just temporary, so then I know that my resources, that money and everything else, that all the gifts, time, and everything else that God gives, it's all an opportunity and it's something that can be utilized for the performance of mitzvahs. So now we understand why these two statements are both in the same words. Because in order to be in Lavan Garti, in order to keep mitzvahs, when you're in the physical body, it requires an attitude of Im Lavan Garti, this is not my life. My life is spirituality. My life is my connection to God. That's my life. There's an old famous story that the disciple of the holy Baal Shem Tov, the holy Mizritch Magid, Reb Dov Ber, the Magid of Mizritch, whose yahrzeit is going to be next week, Monday, Yud Tes Kislev. The holy Mizritch Magid was a very poor man, and before he became the great master of masters, of all the Hasidic masters, and he lived in the town of Mizritch, and he lived in the slums of the town, very very poor part. The Baal Shem Tov, someone once came to visit the holy Baal Shem Tov, and the Baal Shem Tov says to this simple Jew, a very simple Jew, an unlearned man, and the Baal Shem Tov said to him, "When you go back to Mizritch, I want you to go give regards for me to my great and holy disciple, who is a genius and a very great tzaddik, Reb Dov Ber." This guy never heard of Reb Dov Ber. So when he comes back, he's very happy because the Baal Shem Tov, he's so excited that he can be a messenger of the holy Baal Shem Tov. He comes back to the town, he's inquiring of who is this holy Reb Dov Ber. And no one knows, no one heard of this grand tzaddik and scholar. And after much inquiry, they tell him, "Oh, Beryl the Malamed." There's a guy known as Beryl, he's the Malamed. And so people knew of him, not someone who had much fanfare and much, you know. So he goes and he finds out where he lives, and he comes to the forsaken part of the village, and he comes down. There's a horrible stench, and the homes are all rickety. They're all falling apart, one worse than the other. And he walks into the house, and he can't believe what he sees. It's the house is just a couple of boards, like a little cabin. There's nothing much to. And Mizritch Magid opens up the door, He was a teacher, so he gives him Shalom Aleichem, he welcomes him, but he tells him, "You have to wait, I'll be with you in a little while, because I'm holding a middle," you know, he's teaching, he was hired to teach, so he has to do his job. He's sitting on a tree stump, and the kids that are there are sitting on a plank, which is their bench. And so you can see it's a very makeshift situation. Everything is a little rickety, and the windows, most of them are the panes of the windows are broken. It's cold, it's freezing, and he was looking around and he was horrified by the poverty that he saw. After the Magid finished teaching, the story goes actually a little longer. He went back out, he met his friend, he came back with his friend, but he turns to the Magid because he couldn't understand how a person is living in such poverty. And he says to the holy Magid, he says, "I'm also not a wealthy person, but I have furniture in my house. In my home, I have a bed, I have a couch, I have a table. I have a decent place, but this is just a... How do you live like this? So the Maggid looks at him and the Maggid says, oh, what are you comparing? In the home, a person truly needs a bed, a table, a couch. That's in your home. Indeed, indeed, in one home, in one's home, one really needs that. And this simple person heard what the Maggid was saying, that his life in this world was not his home. This is a temporary passing place. So what happens if you're not so... if you're camping out in the middle of the wilderness, if you're not that comfortable for one night, it's not that bad. That's the attitude. That means im lovan garti, living with govan. Then, tayag mitzvah shamarti. But it's more than that. It's not only the 613 mitzvahs I kept, which means that the physical didn't distract me, but much deeper than that. Not only that there is no distraction from the body, but that the body itself and the physical itself becomes an instrument for the soul. And that's why Yaakov continues. And he says, Vayehi li, it was to me, shor chamor tzoin ve'eved v'shifcha, which means all this material wealth, li is to me, which means my soul, my true self, who I really am, owns all these things. They're all servants of the neshama. They belong to me. They belong to my essence. They belong to my neshama. And I'm not a slave to it. It is a servant of me. And that's what he says. And the other meaning, as we said, is I have Mashiach. Because that's the exact ingredient that we need to have Mashiach. It's the sublimation of the physical, the purification of our physical possessions, geared towards holiness. See, the running away from involvement in the physical world does not bring Mashiach. It might be blissful to the soul, but it doesn't fulfill God's purpose in creation. God's purpose in creation is that we are very much involved in physical life, but physical life that is purposeful. Physical life that is purposeful in everything that we do. And that's why, in the very possessions, in the material wealth, that's where Yaakov is saying, because I have a shor and a chamor, because they belong to me, I don't belong to them. But they belong to me, that's why I have Mashiach. That's why I have shor is Mashiach ben Yosef, chamor, the donkey, is Mashiach ben David. Because that's what it takes to have Mashiach. Now we asked, we had mentioned earlier, why is he symbolizing Mashiach as a donkey? When we would think that Mashiach should be symbolized by something higher. Now it's interesting, when Mashiach will come riding on a donkey, the sages tell us that it's not an ordinary donkey. It's a very special donkey. It's an ancient donkey. It's a donkey that was created in the sixth day of creation by twilight. Right before Shabbos, God created that special donkey, and it was sent on a special mission three times. The donkey of Mashiach appeared in this world three times. The first time it appeared when our grandfather Avram went to the Akedah, went for the binding of Yitzchak. It says he saddled his donkey and he took the wood and the knife and he put it on the donkey and he went towards the Har HaMoriah, the Temple Mount, for the offering of his beloved son Yitzchak. Okay? We have a donkey. So the sages say, this is the same donkey. The donkey Mashiach is gonna ride on is the donkey that Avram went to the Akedah. Then the donkey appears a second time. When Moshe is told by God to go redeem the Jewish people, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu took his wife and his children from Midian and he rode them on the donkey. And he himself didn't go on the donkey, but his wife and family were riding on the donkey and coming back to Egypt. It's the second time the donkey was used. The third time the donkey is going to be when Mashiach will come. He's going to come on the donkey. So we see there's something very, very... I mean, the donkey is like a nice... We don't want to say anything bad about a donkey, but the donkey is not really the nicest... I mean, if Mashiach is going to come, shouldn't he come on a beautiful white stallion? If he's going to come on an animal or on some other nice vehicle, why the donkey? So the Mefarshim try to explain this. The Holy Maral of Prague, in a few places, mentions that the reason why Mashiach is riding on a donkey is because the word chamor has a deeper meaning. And he relates it to the donkey. Chamor, donkey, means pure material, physical. The donkey is a very unsophisticated animal. Generally, we look at it as not too smart. The donkey, he says, has the least form to it. It's almost like just like a, I don't know, insult a donkey, the appearance of a donkey, but it's a very simple animal. Other animals, there is far more design to them. The more design to it, the more it facilitates a spirit, a soul. The donkey is called chamor because it's plain. What we in Hebrew, the word chamer comes from the word chomrios. Chomrios means pure raw material. It's pure material that doesn't have design. Donkey symbolizes matter. Moshiach, Moshe Rabbeinu, Avram Avinu riding above the donkey, the Maral says, means that they were above chomrios. They were not material. They were not part of the material world. They were transcendent. They were above the world. They mastered the world. And that's what it means. They were riding above. They were beyond nature. And they controlled nature. That's Maral's explanation. But there is a much deeper explanation. Taking that very theme of the Maral and explaining it on a deeper level, an incredible depth, Lubavitcher Rebbe says, about the chamor, the donkey. Mashiach doesn't, it's not only that they're above the donkey, then it should have said they're floating above the donkey. They're riding on the donkey. Riding on the donkey means that first of all, they're above it, and they're directing the chomer, they're directing the material physical world in the way they want. But there's something deeper than that. If you're riding on the donkey, that means that the donkey is carrying you to places where you can't go on your own. And that is very deep. It's not just that you're riding on it, you're above it, but it, by you, by the person, by the tzaddik, whoever it is, being in control of the donkey, then the donkey takes the rider to places where the rider could not have gone without the donkey. Which means something very special, that very physical world, which is the ultimate distraction, which is so difficult to overcome, holds the secret to ultimate enlightenment. Ultimate enlightenment. We have no choice. I mean, we can shy away sometimes from the battle. Sometimes we can try to ignore and run into an enclave of holiness. But it's not going to work, and it doesn't work, because God wants the best of the best. He wants to give us his essence. And God's essence will only come through the physical, not through spirituality. The physical contains the secret for ultimate divinity, ultimate godliness, is in the physical from within the physical, because God's essence is hidden in pure matter. And that is why the chamor, the donkey, is the ultimate messianic entity that brings Mashiach, because the light of Mashiach is the purification of physicality. Now that purification of physicality has a history. Amazing. The purification of physicality comes through stages. We see, let's follow this donkey. And let's see the differences, we have to do this very briefly, between the way Avram used the donkey, Moshe used the donkey, and Mashiach uses the donkey. Avram, when he used the donkey, he didn't ride on the donkey. He used it to schlep his luggage. He put the wood, the knife, whatever, or the matchbox, whatever he had, he put it on the donkey. He didn't even have his son or his servants riding on the donkey. The next generation, or a few generations later, when Moshe came with the donkey, Moshe put his wife and children on the donkey, but he himself, the Redeemer himself, did not ride on the donkey. When Mashiach comes, Mashiach himself is going to appear on the donkey. That's one difference between them. Another difference between the three usages of the donkey. In the first case, Avram Avinu, it says, the Pasuk says, Vayachvosh es chamoro. He saddled the donkey. That's what the Torah says. He saddled. He's harnessing the donkey. The Medrash says that from the day the world was created until Avram, no one saddled the donkey. Strange Medrash. No one saddled the donkey. Obviously, there's something very deep over here in what it means, saddling a donkey. The first one who saddled the donkey was Avram. Then, by Moshe Rabbeinu, it says, Vayar kivem ala chamor. He rode, he had them ride on the donkey. His wife and children, they were riding on the donkey. Meaning he didn't just saddle the donkey. He's riding on the donkey. Not himself, but his wife and children, they're riding on the donkey. By Mashiach, even though the Pasuk says he is riding on the donkey, Rashi says, this is a Rashi in Parsha Shemos, Sha'osid melech ha-Mashiach lihi golois olav. The King Mashiach will be revealed on the donkey. You hear that? Not he's going to ride on the donkey. He's going to be revealed on the donkey. He's going to reveal himself on the donkey. So let's understand what's the difference between the three. Purification of physicality is a very, very, very difficult. It's a very, very hard piece of work. And it doesn't happen overnight. If God is going to give us a challenge, Hashem is super ambitious. He created a challenge, a monstrous challenge. It's not easy. And that's where it takes a lot of work. It takes the combined efforts of all of humanity. And the 3.5 that primarily from the first Jew that God said Lech Lecha to, from Avram Avinu, until we haven't yet finished. In working out this donkey. Now these are stages in it. The first stage is pre the giving of the Torah. In pre-giving of the Torah, the world, the physical world, was so thick, coarse, and so dense, and so unhospitable, so unyieldable to Kedusha, to holiness. There was no way to make something physical permeated with holiness, with godliness. The best you can do is harness the physical not to interfere, not to bother. But to make physicality itself holy, to sanctify something physical, wasn't possible. That's why we know that during the entire days until the giving of the Torah, even though Abraham did the whole Torah, Isaac did the whole Torah, it says they did these mitzvahs only in mystical meditations. All the energies we do today by putting on tefillin, we draw down great godly light by having a mezuzah, by eating matzah, by blowing the shofar, by keeping Shabbat, by everything that we do which are physically inclined mitzvahs, involved mitzvahs, they did all those things without physical involvement. They did it through deep meditations and without the utilization of the physical. The reason is because physicality was not a vessel. You couldn't. The physical was so resistant, so dense, so blocking of its divine energy, you couldn't revel in it. So that's why it says that Yaakov, for instance, used his sticks. Last week in the parsha, we have a whole story. Yaakov is peeling sticks and he's making stripes. So it says that when he made those sticks and those stripes, he was really doing the same thing we do with tefillin. Tefillin are like stripes. So he was making those, the white and the stick, those were the tefillin stripes. But it says like this, if you were to find Yaakov's sticks, it would be a great find. A wonderful find. You probably can sell it on eBay and make a lot of money on Yaakov's sticks. But there is no sanctity to those sticks. You put it in a museum, there's no sanctity. Technically, you can throw it in the garbage. You wouldn't want to, because our holy grandfather Yaakov, who would chas v'shalom do that? But there is no intrinsic holiness in those sticks. You have a 13-year-old boy who puts on tefillin. Your son put on tefillin the first day. He didn't even do the tefillin. It's not like your grandfather's tefillin that went through Auschwitz. This is a little boy you just want to make. It's that plain, you know, without any great intentions, puts on tefillin one time. Those tefillin are holy. They're holy. They're holy. They're godly. There's holiness in it. Why? Because holiness has permeated the physical world. That was by the giving of the Torah. So you see from here that the physical world was not ready for Kedusha in the days of Avram Avinu. It wasn't. However, what did they do? What did our patriarchs accomplish? They accomplished clearing the space. They made space for our work. They purified the world enough that later, 7 generations later, we can begin true sublimation and elevation of the physical. It came primarily through their work, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and through 210 years of miserable suffering in which the Jewish people suffered and their egos were broken. See, remember what we said? That every part of the world, the density of the world, is related to the ego of the Jewish animal soul. When the Jewish animal soul was beaten and beaten and beaten and broken for 210 years, it softened the ego, as much as we can understand. It softened the cosmic ego, that which was blocking for divine light to come into the world. It was a purification. After that, the Torah could be given. Once the Torah is given, what happens? We're able to begin the process of actually sanctifying something physical and something earthy and making it holy, paving the way for Mashiach, beginning the process of Mashiach. That's why Avram Avinu does what with the donkey? First of all, he doesn't ride on the donkey. What he does is he's saddling the donkey. Saddling meaning he's preparing. When you saddle a donkey, the donkey can't go do the donkey thing. The donkey is now around you and needing to do what the person wants it to do. So you haven't really done yet. You haven't yet fixed it. You're just preparing it. That's what Avram did. He neutralized the donkey, making it ready for a later revelation of divinity. And that is the reason why the donkey could not yet elevate and have Avram ride on it. The most it can do is serve as some kind of an assistance to a mitzvah. So he puts the wood and the knife on the donkey. But he or his family are not elevated by it. Moshe Rabbeinu is already the next stage. The next stage where the world is going into the phase two of rectification. The material world is going into its second stage of elevation. At the second stage, Moshe Rabbeinu's family is already riding on it, which means there is already an elevation in the Jewish soul as a result of the physical material world. Physicality is already elevating the soul because holiness and godliness is already coming from the physical. It's already coming from the material world. And that's why it can carry and elevate the soul. However, which level of the soul can it elevate? The lower level of the soul. The part of the neshama that's closer to the body. That's called, we spoke about it last week, the nefesh ruach neshama. The lower part, the tail end of the neshama that goes into the body, that part of the soul is elevated through the mitzvah that was done with the physical. But the higher part of the neshama, the soul itself, the chay yechida, the real higher divine part, that is not yet elevated, and that's why Moshe is not riding on the donkey. His wife and children, which represent the lower part of Moshe. His wife is like his body, which means the part of Moshe that's in the body. His children are called, the feet of their father. So it's like the lower part of Moshe. Mashiach, however, is not only going to ride on a donkey, he's going to be revealed on the donkey. And it's Mashiach himself, because at the end of days, after 3.5 millennia of purification, there's going to be something so amazing. Not only is godly light going to permeate and blast through the physical, but here's something amazing. Physicality is going to open up and begin to talk and reveal its ultimate secret. Not only is it going to be transparent to spiritual energy, physical life itself, physicality is going to reveal something about God that the spiritual worlds can't reveal. And that is the very, very essence of God, that God is and he has no cause. No one created God. God is with an absolute beingness. The only creature that knows, we once spoke about this in a shir on Tchias HaMesim, it's a deep concept, just going to say it in a moment. The only creature that knows what it is to exist without a cause is physicality. So the physical is it's an amazing thing. The physical is the ultimate and the greatest blockage on God, and yet the physical, once it's turned around, and once it's purified, expresses to us something about God that spirituality can't reveal. And that depth of truth is going to be revealed in the Chomer, in the physical, when Mashiach comes. So Mashiach is being revealed from the donkey. And that's why when Yaakov Avinu, and I'll just conclude, when our forefather Yaakov says he's ready for Mashiach, let's take a deeper look on one statement. The sages say, when there are not virtuous, remember we said earlier, when we're not meritorious, Mashiach comes through the donkey. When we are virtuous, and we do merit, Mashiach comes through the clouds. So the way we think is, when you learn the Gemara before the Hasidic touch, see, the Hasidic masters take every concept and they flip it upside down. The way we understand it usually is like this. Merit is a better thing. When we're meritorious, Mashiach comes through the clouds. When we're not meritorious, when we don't merit, it comes from the earth. but they say, no. Take a look at the word merit. Merit means pure. Zachu means zach. Zach means pure. When our service to God is in heavenly matters, when we're serving God by detaching ourselves from physical life, and our service of God is very spiritual, it's very soul-like, but it's not engaging the body, that's called zachu, pure, because we're remaining in the worlds of purity. So that's great, we're going to get the Mashiach, but we're going to get a Mashiach that comes from heaven. And the Mashiach that comes from heaven, is divine light coming from heaven, has limitations. If our service is loy zachu, if we're serving God with things that are not pure, if we're serving God in dealing, in purifying that parts of the world that are dense, opaque, thick, blocking, not clean, and our service is to purify that which is not clean, then Mashiach comes from the donkey, which means Mashiach is going to sprout forth from the earth, not from heaven. And that's a much godlier Mashiach, a much holier Mashiach. Emes me'eretz titzmach, truth will sprout forth from the earth. Then we're going to get the incredible revelation of the divine essence, not divine light, that comes only when earth is purified. And since Yaakov Avinu purified and went to the house of Lavan and worked in a place that's loizachu, a place that's not clean, and over there he purified, he comes back to Esav and he says, Vayhi li chamor, I have a donkey. I have a Mashiach riding on a donkey. I have a revelation coming from the very earthiness of this world. May we merit for Hashem's light to shine from the heaven, to shine from the earth, to shine from all four directions. May we all experience the coming of Mashiach now.